It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, on Sunday, you probably heard about the reporting. Large anti-corruption protests sweeping across Russia on the weekend. There you hear sound from one of them. Actually, more than 80 cities saw these protests, many of them organized by opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who has now been arrested and jailed for, I believe, 15 days. Protests that have been the biggest since 2012, when tens of thousands came out against the Kremlin over allegations of widespread voter fraud. We have to remember, this is also in Russia, where since that time, even staging peaceful one-person protests are regularly protesters. If you stand on a street corner and protest, you can be detained under the country's harsh anti-demonstration laws. So it's really remarkable. Sunday, tens of thousands of Russians protesting to show their anger at high-level corruption. This hour, we want to use that as a jumping-off point and listen to some researchers here in Iowa who have been studying corruption and how it affects a society's politics. Joining us, first of all, Marina Zalosnaya. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Iowa, and the author of an upcoming book titled The Politics of Bureaucratic Corruption in Post-Transitional Eastern Europe, coming out in April on Cambridge University Press. Marina, welcome back to our program. It's been a few years.
Thank you very much, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
And I want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Not necessarily perhaps you've lived in Russia, perhaps you've lived in other countries, certainly plenty of countries around the world that have a lot of corruption. Perhaps you'd like to share your experience coming into contact with corruption. 1-866-780-9100. Questions as well. Welcome this hour, of course. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Marina, give us, since you study corruption, how it changes a political society, give us your reaction to these protests. Was this a surprise to you? I mean, citizens of Russia are told directly, do not come out into the street and protest, and they come out in the tens of thousands. I think the estimate I saw was 150,000.
Well, the estimates actually are a little bit lower. I think you're thinking about maybe the previous bout of protests.
Not even nationwide.
No, nationwide, the independent estimates are somewhere between 8 and 20,000 people.
Okay.
However, it is still extremely, extremely exciting that many people have managed to come out. And importantly, in contrast to protests that happened in 2011, and 2012, these protests brought together people throughout Russia, right? So protests happened in over 80 different towns in areas and regions that were previously actually had zero oppositional activity in them. So these events are significant, are surprising, and they're curious because they happen at a very interesting political moment, right? So Russia is preparing for the next round of presidential elections. So the next presidential elections are coming up next year. And now is the time when, you know, essentially we see the battle for the presidential position beginning to unfold. Putin has not yet announced his intention to run for the second consecutive term. Actually, you know, this will be his fourth term overall, but it will be his second consecutive term since 2012. Expectations of all political analysts, he will be running. And the protests that we saw on Sunday were organized by, as you mentioned, Alexei Navalny, who is a leading oppositional figure on Russian political arena currently. And they were happening in response to a documentary that Navalny put out on the internet, in which he revealed the accumulation of wealth by one of Putin's closest allies, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. And at the end of the documentary, Navalny announced his own intention to run for the position of president. Mm-hmm. So this is surprising as well as interesting, and the response of Russian government to these protests will be extremely telling.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it? I mean, corruption has existed throughout Russian society for a long time. Why now a protest against corruption? Since you, as a Russian who grew up in that area, experienced it every day. Why now is corruption the point of the spear as far as a protest?
Absolutely. This is a very important question. In the context of economic sanctions against Russia, mounted by the West, as well as the dropping price, or sorry, not maybe not dropping necessarily currently, but very low, historically low prices of oil, rising levels of unemployment and inflation, Russians have not been doing really well economically. In this context, where people's disposable incomes have been essentially falling over the last 4 years, revelations about unbelievable riches amassed by politicians have particular resonance with the public sentiment. Another reason why now is that the message that Putin has used to unify Russians and kind of hold them strong in the face of economic trouble was that of national unity and reviving national identity and sort of the growing importance of Russia as a geopolitical actor. And this message is starting to fade. Mm. It's becoming weaker and weaker as, the annexation of Crimea that happened in 2014 is sort of becoming more and more distant past.
That was the reason for the sanctions by the West, right?
Exactly. Right. Absolutely.
And so it's fading.
It is fading.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who are the protesters? Mm-hmm. And when we say 15, 20,000 across all of Russia, not very many. Russia is a vast land, but quite a few when they are told to stay home and not to protest at all. What can you say about who these people are?
Right. And it is very interesting who these people are, because these people are mostly young, right? And in terms of the age distribution of the protesters, we see significantly more younger people, college students, teenagers coming out relative to the previous bout of protests. So what this tells us is that Putin's message about revival of national identity and alleged Russian greatness on the international arena is not resonating with this specific group, right? We don't know for sure, but it's easy to guess why. These people were born in the post-Soviet period, and they do not have the same kind of nostalgia for, that Russian greatness as, for instance, their parents and grandparents used to. Basically what this is telling us is that Putin really needs to come up with an alternative message, a different way to bring people together if he wants to remain president and if he wants to maintain extremely high levels of popular support that he's enjoyed so far in his upcoming presidential term. And, I'm saying upcoming because there is very little doubt that he will win mm-hmm. the presidential elections.
You said a moment ago, Marina, that the reaction of the Putin and the Kremlin will be key here. What have we seen so far in the last couple of days in terms of reaction? Do we have hints about, many hundreds of these protesters were jailed?
Yes, and in Moscow alone, 1,000 of people was detained, and by estimates of independent monitors, another 400 or so were detained throughout Russia. So far, the reaction has been could be characterized as a reaction of surprise and confusion. In reaction to previous bout of protests in 2012, Russia essentially blamed United States, and specifically Hillary Clinton, who was the sitting Secretary of State at the time. Mm-hmm. And that the message was that somehow United States has fermented the disgruntlement and has paid the protesters. So far, in regards to this protest, Putin's administration no longer has this easy, convenient message to fall back on because, clearly the administration has changed. And what we see coming from Kremlin is that, there is repeated statements of, protesters being paid and, the young teenagers who do not know what they're doing are coming out and are actually being paid by someone. But it remains unclear about who would have paid these people and, why would that motivate them to come out?
And it was interesting in the reporting on this, looking at a BBC report that The state TV channels, the state media were silent until the Kremlin spokesperson offered the explanation that you just put forward for why were these protests. And once the Kremlin spokesperson said, oh, they were paid to turn out, state TV and radio then picks up that line as well?
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, as you said, they essentially turn silent. I've, in preparation for today's show, I've looked at Russian state television's and media channels' reports, and there's hardly anything at this point in time talking about the protest 2 days later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting, perhaps, at this point, Marina, you've experienced the media, the news media in both cultures. To give us an idea of how growing up in Russia or Ukraine, how that is different when you we talk about the news media compared to the United States.
Right. So when I was growing up in the region, and I grew up in Crimea, which at the time when I was growing up was a part of independent Ukraine and now is a part of Russia, media was relatively free, and it remains relatively free in Ukraine. However, in Russia, we see a completely different situation where pretty much all media, all broadcasting that ordinary citizens consume through TV or through printed editions is controlled by the state. So oppositional politicians, like, for instance, Alexei Navalny in his mayoral bid in 2013, do not get any press whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Right. So it is very rare to see any mention of them. And if these mentions are made, they're made in a very negative light. So, when Sergei Navalny in the mayoral bid, in the election for a mayor of Moscow managed to receive around 27% of the vote, it was extremely interesting because, you know, it is hard to do relying exclusively on the internet sources. And he's been very masterful at using his blog and YouTube and other internet-based channels for disseminating his message.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Marina Zalosnaya. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Iowa, also a native Russian, and has lived in the United States now many years, but has been researching corruption in the region. She has an upcoming book, The Politics of Bureaucratic Corruption in Post-Transitional Eastern Europe, coming out at the end of April. And is also involved in some research. Marina, involved in research with another guest we've had on this program who joins us now. Bill Reisinger is a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, joins us now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Ben. Happy to be with you.
Great to have you join us. Just jumping out of a class that you were teaching, Marina's been giving us her reaction to the protests. We want to talk about the research that you and Marina have been conducting on Russia, corruption, and so forth. But first of all, give us your reaction to this past weekend's protests.
Well, they're certainly very interesting in the sense that they had bigger numbers out on the streets than people have seen for a while, and they were evidently not expected by the administration in a way that the Russian leadership seemed to be unsure how to react. There was no coverage on the media, and they responded in a fairly heavy-handed way, but still it didn't seem like they were clear on how they wanted to deal with this.
We're talking about the opposition leader Alexei Navalny and his use of the internet, his use of social media. Let's listen to a little bit of a video that became a sort of a viral sensation, reached a lot of Russians. We'll hear just a bit of it. It's, of course, in Russian. But just to give you a sense of it, this is one of the videos that Alexei Navalny put out. Let's listen.
Но когда вы посмотрите этот ролик Фонда борьбы с коррупцией, вы поймете, насколько мы все ошибались.
According to the translation I was given, Dmitry Medvedev, prime minister and former president of Russia, is crazy about money, he says, and elite real estate, not gadgets like we thought. I hope that's a pretty good translation there, Marina. So, Bill, Marina talking earlier that the result of sanctions, Western sanctions on Russia, also low oil prices have really impacted the average German. And this opposition leader, Navalny, is pointing out that there are corrupt elite who are living the high life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has to be very galling for Russians who are in a poor economic situation, either, you know, a flat income or actually a real decline in their income in recent years, which is, you know, characteristic of most people in the country. So, you know, when they have any kind of credible evidence, it can, you know, it really is an emotional thing. I saw that video. I have had a chance to watch the video that Navalny put together. And there's some pretty incredible things. It is available with English subtitles. Mm-hmm. So someone who doesn't speak Russian but wants to see this. And, you know, so I don't know to what extent it would be acceptable in a court of law, but it certainly brings together a lot of evidence that's you know, very that paints a very bad picture of the country's number two politician, and one who had, when he was occupying the presidency for 4 years, was trying to cultivate a reputation as fighting for modernization and economic development and rule of law in the country. And so his the reality of his situation certainly undermines the reputation he tried to paint for himself.
Mm-hmm. What is your explanation, Bill, for why, even though authorities say you will not go out into the streets and protest in any numbers, why tens of thousands, maybe 20,000, went out on Sunday to defy the authorities?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things is just that the kind of authoritarian rule that Russia has is what you might call a soft form of authoritarianism. So the extent to which the regime uses repression on the public is limited. It tries to use it strategically and to allow a certain amount of freedom. So even in the media sphere, for example, they have not followed China's policy of cracking down on the internet as extensively as China does. So people who are interested in finding out alternative points of view from what the mainstream media has, what the Russian official government media presents, they can do that. And so, you know, that creates the capability of people to hear about things like Navalny's video in the country. So in that kind of context, the government is banking on their ability to isolate opposition people rather than in a large-scale way really repress everyone and prevent information flow and other things that were characteristic of the Soviet period.
Mm-hmm. Do they not have that option? You mentioned the Chinese would censor and really control the internet as they do today. Do they not have that option, so they have to choose this softer authoritarian way of trying to control information?
I think they do have the option. Of course, it's super expensive, but they technically and financially could do that if they chose to. But I think it's a strategy that the regime is following, to have the softer form. And among other things, that's why they have elections where there are multiple candidates on the ballot. Again, that's different from China, multiple parties and multiple candidates. So they need to have elections where there are opposition parties on the ballot, but those parties can't win any power. And so it's a tricky game that kind of political system plays. And again, what everyone is curious about with regard to Sunday's protests are just how does that impact next year's presidential election? Not that Putin won't win, because everyone expects him to, but might it make it more difficult, more controversial? Mm-hmm. Might it lower his vote totals?
Mm-hmm. Marina, you wanted to jump in here.
Yes. I also would like to add that corruption has proven to be a very resonant issue and a very effective issue to mobilize people around in the region as well as worldwide. You know, we've seen waves of pro-democratic and anti-government protests engulf Eastern Europe through the mid-2000s, right? We saw the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003, Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004. In both of these places, people were guided by the belief that the elites are corrupt and you know, mobilized around the idea to stop the large-scale embezzlement. We also have seen similar kinds of claims in the protests in the Arab Spring, as well as the Occupy movement in the developed West. I think that Navalny is a very shrewd politician in a sense that he chose the correct issue. There are other opposition leaders effective politicians in opposition in Russia. For instance, Garry Kasparov, a famous former chess player, has not been as effective because his issues, appeals have revolved around absence of civil and political liberties, and somehow these issues have not gotten ordinary Russians to come out.
So corruption will motivate Russians to come out into the street in a way that a lack of democracy will not. How is that word, that idea, democracy, viewed in Russia today, Marina?
Right. Ever since the notion of human rights has been developed in the international arena, people in the Soviet Union, that part of the world, have, guided by their leaders, have emphasized different sets of rights, right? They have emphasized social and economic rights over the political and civil rights that have been emphasized by the leaders of the United States as well as Western Europe. So this primacy that's given to the economic issue has a very long political history in Russia, right? So the ideas that we tend to associate with democracy, the ideas, freedoms of speech and expression and religion, are simply not as historically close mm-hmm. to an ordinary Russians.
Mm-hmm. Not embedded in their constitution
exactly.
as they are here. So they think about it. You agree with that, Bill, that democracy, freedom of the press, is just has a different sense in Russia than it does here in the United States.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I would also add that the 1990s was a time of two things happening in Russia. One was that the people were told that they were going to democratize and become a democracy. And the other thing was a terrible, terrible economic depression, and hyperinflation and unemployment and other things. So those kind of became linked. Well, if this is democracy, then we don't want it.
Okay. We have to take a short break. Back with Bill Reisinger, professor of political science at the University of Iowa, along with Marina Zalaznaya. And they are, she's also at the University of Iowa, sociologist there. We'll talk about their research together when we come back. They're looking at the impact of corruption on political behavior, primarily in Russia to start off with. We'll talk about that. And ask Marina, having grown up in that society, what are the everyday bits of corruption that you experience as a young person growing up in Russia these days? We'll be back with more of River to River in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Using the protests, surprising protests in Russia on Sunday as a jumping off point to talk about what's happening there. We have to remember in Russia these days, even staging a peaceful protest, if you're just one person, will get you detained under that country's anti-demonstration laws. Yet on Sunday, we saw maybe tens of thousands of Russians protesting across the country in upwards of 80 different cities and towns to show their anger at high-level corruption. We're getting some insights on this from Marina Zalaznaya, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. I misspoke at the beginning. She's assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa, author of the upcoming book, The Politics of Bureaucratic Corruption in Post-Transitional Eastern Europe, that coming out in April. Also, Bill Reisinger is with us, professor of political science at the University of Iowa, offering his insights. A little later in the program, Wayne Moyer, one of our regular political analysts, will be on the program to give us his view of these protests, but also his reaction, interpretation of the latest drip, drip, drip of new information about Russian influence in our 2016 election. But Marina and Bill, let's talk a little bit about the research that you are working on together. Marina, start us off. What did you set out to do with this look at the impact of corruption on political behavior in Russia?
In the summer of 2015, Bill, myself, and Vicky Claypool, who is also a professor of political science at the University of Iowa, collected representative sample survey data from Russia as well as two other Eastern European countries, Ukraine and Georgia. In this survey, we asked ordinary Russians about their informal economic behaviors, so essentially about their interactions with ordinary street-level officials that work in service provision organizations and the exchanges that they accomplish with these officials under the table. As well, we asked about these people's political behavior and political attitudes. So now we have data on small-scale bureaucratic corruption or this kind of unsanctioned informal exchanges under the table. And we have data on the political attitudes and behavior. And recently in two separate papers, we have linked these two sets of data to show that people's own participation in bureaucratic corruption lowers their support for the political regime in Russia, specifically for Putin's regime, and demobilizes them in voting, right? So not only do they think worse of the regime itself, they trust the politician less, they evaluate their performance as worse, but they're also either less likely to vote in general, right? If they were going to go out to the polls and vote for Putin, they're more likely to stay at home. And for those who were more likely to stay at home, these people are actually more likely to go out and to vote for a Putin opponent, right, for a candidate other than Putin in the elections.
Bill Reisinger, perhaps you want to add to that, but how surprising are the this nexus between the level of corruption in a society and the level of which a person participates in low-level corruption and how they feel about the politics of the country?
Well, it's been part of the literature on corruption for a while to debate whether engaging in corruption is generally going to make people feel worse about their political system, or might actually ironically make them feel better about it, because it would be a way to circumvent challenges. It would be a way to get things done and to go about their lives that you would figure out how to bribe and when to bribe, and you'd sort of get the hang of it. And then that would make life easier.
So you're saying, Bill, just to jump in here, that when we think of corruption, we think of it as unmitigated, something bad. Right. But if you live in an authoritarian system like they do in Russia these days, you might not think of it that way.
Well, yeah, and so that's the literature has that possibility, and we went into it wanting to know. So how does it play out in Russia? What is going on? So as Marina noted, what we found pretty strongly is that it turns people off from the bureaucrats they deal with, those service providers on the street, whether it's a traffic police officer or whether it's an inspector for a building or something, whatever it might be. They feel like their encounters are much less satisfactory if they've involved bribery in any way. And they transfer that to broader and more distant political organizations. So they feel, for example, those who have more involvement in corruption as part of their daily lives, they feel like there's more corruption in society as a whole, that the political leaders are more involved in corruption, and that corruption has increased in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Marina, you are Russian. You grew up in Crimea, I believe you said, the part of Ukraine that had been annexed by the Russian state recently. Tell us, you've lived both in the United States now for a long time, but also grown up in Ukraine and are Russian. What is the difference? It's not like we don't have some corruption here in the United States, but give us an idea of what you encounter living, growing up in that society and encountering corruption. Where do you encounter it? How do you encounter it as an everyday person?
Of course. Corruption is probably a characteristic of any political system, right? So corruption arguably happens in every country, in every political regime. However, in Russia, as well as in other countries of the former Soviet Union, small-scale bureaucratic corruption, like the kind of corruption that we study with Bill and Vicky, is a characteristic of life, of everyday life for ordinary citizens. So, in fact, our data suggests that close to 20% of Russians have either been asked by a bureaucrat to give a bribe or have offered and given a bribe you know, out of their own volition in the course of the previous year. So, you know, 20% is definitely, you know, it's not pervasive or ubiquitous. However, it's very common, you know, and if we think
And in what scenarios would you find
what
it
scenarios?
Typically?
So there is generally two ways that this can happen. Usually either a bureaucrat asks for a bribe or a person offers a bribe, and in exchange for a bribe, a present or a favor, a bureaucrat would either do something that he or she is supposed to do by law, for instance, you know, do a series of tests as a doctor or give a grade.
You pay bribes to your doctor?
Absolutely. Absolutely, you do. You do that kind of as a condition of service. Or alternatively, in order to receive an extra legal service, so to get, let's say, a more quality service or more timely service. So this can be either or. It can be either to get things that you are entitled to by law or to get better things.
But also a police officer pulling you over.
Absolutely.
It would be common to be
in fact,
asked, yeah.
Yeah, we find that traffic police encounters with traffic police was the most common scenario in which Russians have paid bribes in the course of the preceding year, followed by encounters with higher educational officials and governmental officials and hospital.
Okay, people out there are saying, well, if that happened here, I'd refuse to pay it, and I might even go try to turn that official in. What if you tried that in Russia these days? I'm going to talk to your captain, and we'll see about paying this. What
of course.
Would happen?
Well, you know, people are stakeholders in this kind of exchanges. A lot of them are not interested in turning them in because they benefit from these exchanges as well, right? They do get their services better or faster. They also, you know, a lot of Russians have low trust in police and formal institutions, and therefore they are not likely to report because they don't think this will lead to anything. Or alternatively, they're afraid as well because they might risk punishment themselves. So our data show that not many people report, you know, corrupt exchanges to officials.
Okay. Marina Zalesnaya is with us, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa, along with Bill Reisinger, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Also joining us as we finish up this hour, Wayne Moyer is with us, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk a little bit. We've been talking about the protests. I think you've been on the line listening. What other reaction do you have to the Russian protests on Sunday?
Well, a couple of things. One is how widespread, and this has come out in your earlier discussion, these protests were. My principal question is, how will Putin react to this?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent will he tighten up things at home? And then to what extent will he sort of play up the American threat to Russia as a way of trying to mobilize nationalistic domestic support? Or will he ignore the protests? And it's not, to me, clear at this stage what his reaction will be.
Mm-hmm. Bill Reisinger, let me go to you. Do you see yet a clear reaction by the Kremlin to these protests, which caught them a little bit surprised?
Yeah, no, I don't think we have a good sense yet of a long-term strategy. That is a strategy between now and next March when the presidential elections will happen. I would add that one other possibility we ought to keep in mind is he will try some strategy, which is the Chinese do, which is blame local officials, try to have some heads roll at lower levels to try to dissociate it from Putin and the higher level people. One of the things that's clever about Navalny's video that criticized the prime minister is that the prime minister Medvedev is just so closely tied to Putin that it would be very difficult for Putin to distance himself from Medvedev at this point.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, let me have you react to the latest drip, drip, drip of new information about Russian influence in our election. And there's a good deal of new information since we last spoke with you just over the last few days. So we have calls growing for the Republican chairman of the key intelligence panel to recuse himself. Devin Nunes revealing on Monday that he had met with an intelligence official on the White House grounds before announcing there was evidence he had seen to indicate the Trump campaign and transition were scooped up in incidental, what is called incidental surveillance. What do you make of what Nunes did in light of the other information out there?
Well, I think there are serious questions now as to whether the House Intelligence Committee investigation can really be unbiased and can really make a fair inquiry into what the Russian involvement in the election really was. Hal Nunes could have gotten into the White House grounds without the president or somebody close to the president knowing about it, why he then went to the president first, revealing what he had found out without telling members of his committee. All of that makes one wonder to what extent that what Nunes is doing was operating under the direction of the president or somebody very closely linked to the president. And since Nunes is involved in the transition to the Trump administration, then one wonders whether he, in fact, would be able to lead a fair investigation. And then the other thing that I think is important is he canceled a hearing, which I think was scheduled for today, where Sally Yates, who had been the acting attorney general at the beginning of the administration, holdover from the Obama administration, was going to testify in terms of what she had told the White House from the FBI in terms of the involvement of Michael Flynn with the Russians around the time of the election. And there was some question that the administration was trying to prevent her from testifying, and hence that the investigation or the hearing today was called off.
That is the Washington report, Post reporting that today, that the Trump administration did, in fact, seek to block that former acting attorney general, Sally Yates, from testifying to Congress. Also interesting here to comment yesterday, Donald Trump's son-in-law and trusted advisor, Jared Kushner, offering to testify to senators about meetings with senior Kremlin officials, including the head of a bank closely linked to Putin's government. Wayne.
Yeah, well, the question there, I think, is was there some kind of deal in the making between the Russian government and the United States where the United States would end or work to end the sanctions against Russia over Ukraine in return for something on the part of the Russians, which wasn't clear, but one could raise the question as to whether Kushner was, in fact, before the administration actually came into office, beginning to work on such a deal. And I think that that is also one of the subjects of the investigation. To what extent did these negotiations get much further than they should have gotten before the new president took office?
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, or president, last night launching a bit of a Twitter barrage. Let me read from a couple of tweets put together. Why isn't the House Intelligence Committee looking into the Bill and Hillary deal that allowed a big uranium to go to Russia? Russia speech money to Bill, Hillary, Russian reset, praise of Russia by Hillary, or Podesta Russian company. Trump's Trump-Russia story is a hoax. So what do you make of how the Trump administration, specifically Donald Trump through his tweets, Wayne, is reacting to these investigations and the revelations that come to us almost on a daily basis?
Well, once again, I think what he's trying to do is to change the subject. I think it's been well established that though there was a deal where a Russian company could buy significant shares of an American uranium mining company, they would not, by the way, get the right to export the uranium. That Hillary Clinton personally had absolutely nothing to do with that. So this is a smokescreen.
Mm-hmm. Last time, I think a couple of weeks ago when you were on, Wayne, you mentioned this whole thing was sounding more and more like Watergate. Are you feeling that way these days as well?
I still think that this is the case. Every day something new comes out. Last week it was Paul Manafort's dealings with the pro-Russian government in the Ukraine. And it's like every two or three days something new comes out. And over a period of time, this has to have a very negative effect on the presidency.
Well, you maybe have heard this, the former White House counsel to President Nixon, John Dean, there's a name that people who lived through Watergate will remember. He was charged for helping to cover up the Watergate scandal. He says he thinks President Trump's White House is now in cover-up mode. Here he is a few days ago, John Dean, speaking with MSNBC's Chris Hayes when asked about the administration's response to the ongoing investigations of Russia ties and Trump's wiretapping accusations. Let's listen a moment.
Let me tell you how predictable this is and how cover-up-ish it is, because this is exactly what happened during Watergate. For example, when it came clear, when I had broken rank and became a public person out there, suddenly Nixon had never had any meetings with me at all. Then he'd had one or two meetings with me. Well, we had 37 meetings about Watergate. And he knew damn well that we had been deep in the thicket of it. But suddenly they distanced themselves. Wow. That's exactly what we're seeing here. When the break-in occurred, for example, of Watergate, and Hunt and Liddy were uncovered, and the fact they worked at the White House, suddenly they had done nothing at the White House. They'd had no real assignments. So this is classic cover-up, Chris. It's what we're seeing.
Okay. Former White House counsel to President Nixon commenting on what's going on today. Bill Reisinger, I wonder what your views are as we watch what's going on with Russia, the Russia investigation in Washington.
Well, I do think that there's seems to be a fair amount of evidence that the people close to the incoming president prior to inauguration were doing things that undermined then U.S. policy, and that's really something that goes against the way that incoming administrations should operate. So, then all the question about what's out there and what's going on makes this all very confusing. The other thing that seems to be on hold while all that discussion of Russian relations keeps going on is that the U.S. doesn't really have a policy toward Russia. We haven't heard articulated a sense of, are we going to continue the same policy toward Russia that the Obama administration have? Are we going to change it? If so, in what direction? There haven't been the kind of personnel put into key positions in the State Department and elsewhere to guide a foreign policy toward Russia, but I think we really need to have some clear and consistent sense of what we want to do with Russia.
Mm-hmm. But finally, before we go, Wayne, tell me, what are the key questions that you have at this point about links between Russian officials and the influence they had on the 2016 campaign, but also the contacts, possible contacts with Donald Trump's presidential campaign?
Well, I think the biggest question is, was there any kind of coordination between people and Trump's entourage and Russian security people during the election campaign? And then also, how far did this arrangement of progress toward a Russian-American deal progress? One thing that concerns me about this, and this goes on with what John Dean was saying, I think we may be getting to the stage where the administration is spending so much time on this issue, the issue of the investigations going on, that it doesn't really have time to consider all of the other issues which the administration has to face. The same problem that the Nixon administration faced during Watergate.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry that with this administration's focus on sort of internal controversies that we could, Wayne, have a real crisis somewhere in the world that the United States, as the world leader, would need to react to and wouldn't be able to do so in the way that it should?
I worry most about North Korea, which is, I think, on the verge of another nuclear test, and it's been testing long-range ballistic missiles. And will we really be able to give that issue the attention that it deserves?
Okay. Wayne Moyer, always good to talk with you. Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Also, Bill Reisinger, Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Wayne, Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
My pleasure.
And with us for the entire hour, Marina Zalaznaya, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. And we'll be watching for that book coming out, The Politics of Bureaucratic Corruption in Post-Transitional Eastern Europe. Excited to hear when that book comes out. Marina, thank you for stepping into our studio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. With help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, already Wednesday, Politics Wednesday. Hope you'll tune in and join our discussion. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.